Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Live from Joe Hawk Hall on Saturday night. This really is an absolute pleasure for me. To be asked to come down here is, you know, when Mark called me up and said, "Hey, I want you to come down and do a workshop, speak." I'm like, I couldn't believe it. Mark's been a hero of mine for since 94 or 5 when I first got a hold of some of the workshop tapes. And to be able to come down here is really, really great. On or around December 28th, 1989, the grace of God separated me from alcohol. It was a brutal period of time for me. Willingness, only born of desperation, shoved me toward what I thought was my only possible hope, the only plan that was out there, and that was to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did that with a fervor, and through a course of events and being exposed to some really wonderful people, I haven't seen the need to take a drink since that day. I'm very, very grateful for that. I want to start my story at the beginning. I was born at a very early age. One of my first memories. Okay, here's one of my first memories. I remember my mother came up to me. I'm about 5, and she said, "Chris, kindergarten starts today. You're going to kindergarten." And I'm like, "What?" And she's like, "Yeah, you're going to really like this. I'm taking you to kindergarten. Get dressed." I get dressed. I don't really know what's going on. She throws me in a car. She drives me across town. She parks at the top of this hill. She opens up the door and she says, "See you later." And I remember getting out of the car. She drives away and I'm standing up on top of this hill looking down at the school. And the kids are already down there. They're running around. They're playing tag and kickball. They've already they've already made friends with each other. There's already peer groups starting. I'm standing up there on top of the hill going, "Oh, you know, there's something wrong here. This is not a good idea." You know, I was filled with self-centered fear. I was thinking, what if they don't accept me? What if I get beat up? What if they ostracize me? I'm worried about all this stuff. I'm 5. I know enough that I need to go do this deal. So I act as if everything's okay inside me. I'm freaking out. I act as if everything's okay inside me, and I walk down and I start the kindergarten thing. Okay. Now, what I remember of school, what I remember of the first 6 or 7 years of school, it's really not pretty. I mean, I was not having a good time. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. I was never comfortable with myself or my environment. I was always worried about what you were thinking about me. I was, I always had this anxiety, and there would be like an oral report where I'd have to get up in front of the class, and I'd cut school that day. Then I'd cut 3 days after that just in case there's a makeup. I mean, I was just freaking out, and I was acting as if everything was okay because you had to be cool, you know what I mean? So I was acting as if everything was okay, and it was traumatic for me. I was looking at you guys and I was thinking, how do you do it? How are you like okay with this whole thing? I'm like freaking out, but I can't tell anybody. So I get to about 7th grade or something like that. I've got a couple of friends, and we decide that we're going to cut school, we're going to go back to my mother's house, and we're going to get drunk. Okay, this sounded like a really cool thing to do. We could brag about it at school the next day. It was like dangerous and on the outside a little bit, and that attracted me. So that's what we did. We went back to my mother's house. We cut school. And I didn't know anything about drinking at this period of time. The only exposure, I don't come from an alcoholic family. People that do, God bless you, you understood probably more than I did. The only thing I knew about drinking was the John Wayne movies. You remember the John Wayne movies? He'd bust through the saloon doors. He'd go, "Bartender, whiskey." You know, the bartender would pour a big water glass of whiskey out. He'd drink like the whole glass down, grab the bottle, go back to the table, shoot somebody in a little while, you know. And so that's what I did. I poured these big water glasses of Four Roses Canadian whiskey. You know, to this day, I have like a Pavlovian response to this. If I smelled that Four Roses, forget it. Here's what happened. Let me first tell you what happened to the two guys I was drinking with. They never became alcoholic. As far as I know, they never became problem drinkers. What they did was they drank about two-thirds of their glass, and they had had enough. You ever drink with people that have enough? Isn't that annoying? No, thanks. I've had enough. Are you crazy? Let's go to the city! You know, I mean, that's the way I drank. It's only 1 a.m. You know, you can get to work still. They had had enough, and they sat back and they watched the show. Because here's what I did. I drank my whole glass, the rest of their glass, the rest of the bottle, and I went into my first blackout. Any blackout drinkers in here? Whoa, that's the most amount of hands I've ever seen, Mark. That is, it's disconcerting to be a blackout drinker, isn't it? I mean, you know, you ask your buddies, by the way, last night was fun, wasn't it? You know, what did we do? You know, you ever like lose your car, forget where you park your car? You ask like an earth person, I need to go look for my car. You need to look for your car? Well, where did you put it? I don't remember. What do you mean you don't remember? Well, blackouts are really disturbing. I mean, you know, I've done some crazy things in blackouts. I got increasingly violent as I drank. I remember, I don't remember this one time, I called up my boss in a blackout and threatened his life. I'm going to kill you! And I quit! Right? Now, I'm in a blackout. So I get dressed, I go to work the next day, I walk in, da-da-da-da-da-da. He's like, what the hell are you doing here? I'm like, what? You threatened my life last night. I did? This type of, you know, you wake up in Topeka with one shoe, you know. Topeka! Hello, Topeka! And because you can't look stupid, you got to pretend that you always go to Topeka with one shoe, you know? Oh, man. I would come to in some very, very strange places with some very strange people. And, you know, it's really disturbing. But anyway, I went into my first blackout. The very first time I drank, I went into my first blackout. Trashed the house, you know, busted windows, made a whole scene, ended up waking up in a field, you know, coming to in a field, like, what am I doing in a field? And the thing was after that, I was horribly ill. Do you remember your first real drunk? I mean, you had to be horizontal for like 2 days. I mean, you're poisoned. You're poisoned. You're like, oh, like vomiting all over yourself. And here's the thing. I mean, I was so sick, it was unbelievable. If anything else would have made me that sick, I never would have gone near it again. If I would have ate a rutabaga and got that sick, I never would have gone near a rutabaga again. I wouldn't have needed to go to a 12-step rutabaga anonymous fellowship. I wouldn't have needed to get a rutabaga eaten sponsor. You know, I wouldn't have needed to get a coffee commitment. I would have had an adequate mental defense to not eat rutabagas. Here's what alcohol did for me, though. And I don't believe that it does this for non-alcoholics. It may, but I don't believe so. You know that scared kindergartner that was always in me, that repressed, anxious, you know, really worried about everything kid that was inside me? When I started to drink that alcohol, all of a sudden I knew a new freedom and a new happiness from that repressed anxiety. All of a sudden, I'm like, ah, you know, like this is the secret elixir of life. Now I can finally feel like you guys. Now I can finally feel like I fit in. I felt larger than life. Okay, I was the funniest guy. You were lucky to be hanging out with me. Who cares what you think about me, you know? I mean, it was a complete shift in perception, and it was an unbelievable amount of freedom. And then I learned how to projectile vomit, you know. But listen, The part that made me so sick, that memory started to fade. But what didn't fade was what alcohol did for me. And from that moment, I became preoccupied with alcohol. I figured I'm never drinking Four Roses again. And to, you know, I never did. I started to drink things like, remember, Boone's Farm apple wine. You know, I'm like 12. You know, Strawberry Hill. Budweiser Schlitz. I mixed it up a little bit. I never drank the Canadian whiskey. But I started to plan where I was going to drink. Who was going to buy it? Because the drinking age was 21. I was 12. That was problematic, you know. But you can always work things out. You can always find a way. I started to figure out where I was going to drink it, who it was going to be with, where we were going to store. I became very, very preoccupied with alcohol. Now, I come from a really smart family. My sister and brother are both college professor PhDs. My mother and father, Phi Beta Kappa. You know, just a really, really smart family. And the moment I started drinking, things started to change with schoolwork for me. Okay, I started to not pay much attention to that. And my grades started to slip, if you can imagine. Now, you know, you always see things in hindsight. I did not say to myself, geez, I'm becoming preoccupied with alcohol. If I keep on like this, you know, I may not get into college of my choice. I didn't say that. You know what I said? Things like, who cares? Leave me alone. Get off my back. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, the war cry of the alcoholic. You know, just stay away from me and my booze, okay? It's my business. And I started to do things like take Wednesdays off in high school just to break up the week, you know. Hey, where's Chris today? It's Wednesday. Oh, that's right, it's his day off. You know, I mean, I quickly became incredibly irresponsible. Now there was, this is the late 60s, the very early 70s, so guess what, folks? There was some non-conference approved materials around that you could get your hands on. And believe me, I partook of such things. Whatever it was, I'd eat it, and then I'd ask you, by the way, what was that? You know, I mean, I was looking for anything to get me out of me. I wanted to escape the bondage of Chris like you have no idea. And I was always drunker than anybody else, took more drugs than anybody else. I mean, you know, we had some real times back in those days. I remember the Basking Ridge Quaalude epidemic of 1972. Now, here's what happened. One of my really good buddies brings a big sack of Quaaludes into school. He got them from his brother way late the night before. And he goes, hey, these are Quaaludes. And we're like, well, what are those? Oh, they're great, you know. How many do you take? He goes, three or four. So like 50 of us took like three or four Quaaludes before first period. Okay, by third period, I'm walking down the hall, hanging onto the lockers like this. Finally, I go, I got to make a break for it, okay? This is too much. And I see the exit sign, right? And boom, I go through the exit. Now, what I don't realize is the whole 400 wing is watching me. They love this. They said, Chris, it took you 15 minutes to go 100 yards. You know, I make it outside. Now, you know, I had a lot of fun in the early days with some of this drinking and drugging, but very, very quickly there came problems. There came problems, and I would minimize the problems, but they started to become severe. I crashed a lot of cars. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. Got 3 DWIs. I mean, you know, some of these accidents were unbelievable. I remember allowing myself to become overserved at this one bar, and I'm leaving the bar, and the car spins around on some black ice and hits a bridge abutment going backwards. I get thrown out the back window, and I come to it. I'm looking up at the stars. I'm laying on the trunk with my feet still in the car. I'm, you know, laying on the trunk, and I'm going, this isn't good. I should probably get out of here. Now, the car was bent like a boomerang. There wasn't a window left in it. It had 3 flat tires, and the drive shaft was slapping the frame. What am I going to do? What do we do? We go home, right? We try to head home. So I get in the car, and I'm going about a mile and a half an hour down the road, whacking a book of a bam, whacking a book of a bam with this car. And I go by cops giving radar. I can still see the guy. I mean, he didn't even pull me over. He, like, walked me over. You know what I mean? And he reaches through the window, and he starts shaking me. Where'd you have that accident? I'm like, what accident, officer? I got glass sticking out of my head. I don't know about you guys, but the cops were always hassling me. He goes, where are you going? I go, home. He goes, where's that? I go, Basking Ridge. He goes, that's 28 miles. What are you thinking? You got no tires. Leave me alone. DWI number one. Another time, I'm in Florida, and I'm doing Quaaludes and whiskey again, which, if you're new, we don't recommend you drive on that. It didn't work for me. I misjudged the trajectory going across traffic and got T-boned, you know, on like a highway. Rolled me down the road. I come to and I'm laying on the roof of the car because the car's upside down. And my shoes had been knocked off. This is another important warning sign. If you're ever in an accident and your shoes have been knocked off, that's probably a pretty bad accident. But people are looking in like, is he dead? Is he dead? I crawl out of the car, and I had been thrown through the passenger window and then thrown back into the car. Now, I had glass sticking out of my head really bad. And I mean, this was a head wound. I was bleeding like a stuck pig. I mean, covered with blood. And I'm standing there, like, talking to people. And they're looking at me like, this guy's crazy. And the cops come up. I grab a bystander. I say, listen, call my wife and tell her I'm heading to the hospital. The ambulance is coming and everything. And the cops are like, you know, we're going to give you a blood test when you get to the hospital. So I'm like, all right, officer, I only had one. You know, you're not an alcoholic if you admit to more than one when they pull you over. I just had one. I get to the hospital. I'm in the emergency room. They wheel me in. The cops are coming. They wheel me in, and then they don't pay attention to me. So I'm laying on the gurney. I'm looking around. I'm going, I'm getting out of here. So I jump up off the gurney. I bust through the emergency room doors, through the waiting room. Now, people are like horrified because I'm like covered with blood. I'm like, oh, heading out. I bust through the doors, and I'm heading for the woods. Meanwhile, in comes my wife, her sister, and her sister's boyfriend driving this way. I see them, and I start heading for them. I dive through the window onto their lap and go, you got to get me out of here. They want my blood. They're like, oh! Okay? Now, here's how good the alcoholic is. I talk him into taking me back to the party I was at. Okay? And my wife did. Dropped me off. I go back in the party. A couple of biker chicks are yanking the glass out of my head with pliers. You know, I'm wondering why she wants to leave me, you know? What's the matter with you? Here's my last DUI. I'm driving another evening. I'm allowed to be overserved. I'm on my way home, and supposedly I crossed a double yellow. You know how this is. Supposedly I get pulled over. Now the cop comes to the window, knocks on the window, says license, registration, insurance card, and I'm like, okay. And I am so drunk, I open up the glove compartment. I'm fumbling in the glove compartment for like 5 minutes. I'm so drunk. Finally, I just grab the entire contents of the glove compartment because I can't do it. And I just hand it to him, you know, maps and combs and pens and tissues and everything. You know, the cops are always hassling me. Now, he goes, get out of the car, gives me the sobriety test. I remember very little of this because I was just about in a blackout. But I remember nailing the ABCs, okay? I get taken to jail, you know, booked, everything. Now, the next morning, I remember nailing the ABCs. So I get a lawyer, okay? $1,500 lawyer. We're going to go there. We're going to fight this. The first thing to do, I don't know if they still do this around here, but they videotaped me up at the police station doing all the sobriety tests. Now, I remember getting the ABCs. Now, I'm here with a lawyer. He's in a three-piece suit, you know, $1,500 worth. He's, you know, professional as hell. We go up and we ask for the videotape, and the cop is sniggering when he hands us the tape. He's like this. Now, he puts in the tape, And I'm horrified. Okay? Has anybody in here ever seen yourself taped like really drunk? Whoa! You need like therapy after that. Now, did I nail the ABCs? I sure did. Here's how I nailed them. And then there's me walking the line, and I got my arms on the wall. He's like, Mr. Schroeder, please take your arms off the wall while you're walking the line. I'm like, every 5 seconds I'm asking for a cigarette. I was horrified. And this whole time, the attorney is like, very, very professional. I'm like hiding my head in shame. Then comes the end, and the cop goes, Mr. Schroeder, but before we turn the camera off, is there anything you'd like to add? I look at the camera and I go, like this, right? The attorney just loses it. He's like, "Bah!" Because I've never seen anything like that. "Bah! If you ever had any chance at all of being this, oh!" I'm like, oh my God. So I'm like, I guess we got to plea this one, huh? Yeah! So I get another the cops are always hassling me. Now, these things are happening to me. I got to tell you, one thing after another, problem after problem after problem after problem after problem. Now, somewhere along the line, I become an electrician. Okay, I came to in recovery, and I was an electrician. I was a really bad one too, because it takes some intelligence, or else you start fires, and you get electrocuted. Every day I was getting electrocuted. My hair was like constantly. Some of the things I did, I remember this one time. The people I worked with just couldn't stand me because I was just so lame. I couldn't remember things, and I'd always be shaking. They don't like electricians that are shaking. These people. Now, I remember this one time. I'm working with a guy, and I had done a bunch of heroin the night before, and a lot of whiskey, which is something else we don't recommend. And I had. You know how you're dehydrated in the morning, and you got to rehydrate. Well, this morning I got a half a gallon of grape drink. Just go, 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 go. I rehydrated up, and off to work I go. And I'm sitting there, and I'm putting an electrical panel on somebody's house, and my partner's like over here messing in the truck. And all of a sudden it's like, I'm like, oh. And I've got experience with this, right? I have about 7.2 seconds to get somewhere because I am going to be very, very sick. So I figure, what am I going to do? I don't want this guy to see me. So I know what I'll do. I'll tear around the back of the house. So I tear around the back of the house. I just make it around the back of the house, and whoa, it's like a fire hydrant. Whoa, purple vomit. I like stucco this house. Just stucco this house. Now, I thought I was alone, okay? Now I look over, and about this far away is a family from a neighboring house on a deck. A mother, a father, and three kids have a nice day. And you could tell they were related because they all had the same look on their face. They were like, oh, mommy, mommy, there's a purple puke monster from hell, mommy. Now you gotta act cool, right? I mean, you don't want to look stupid. So I get the hose and I'm, washing out. Yeah, this always happens. Another time, I swear this is true. This is bizarre. I'm working as a maintenance electrician in a department store. The place was called Epstein's. It was like a Macy's or a Bamberger's or something. And they were putting in the computer cash registers at this time. So you had the loop data cable around. This is the mid-80s or something. And so I had this big drill. It was one of those big, huge steel, like 4 horsepower with the bar handles and the locking trigger. And I'm drilling with a big auger bit with an extension down into the floor to drop the cable into the ceiling below. And I'm in the lingerie department, okay? So I'm preoccupied, if you can imagine. Lingerie department. All of a sudden the thing hits a beam and catches. Whoom! And it grabs me and it starts spinning me around like this. It's the drill spins me around, ties me up in the drill, and then rips the pants off my ass. Finally, it unplugs from the wall, and I'm tied to a drill like this with no pants in the lingerie section. All these women are like, again, you got to act cool. You don't want to look stupid. And I'm like, yeah, this drill always does this. Another time, I'm wiring a kitchen addition for some people, you know, wiring a kitchen addition, and I'm running the sub-panel feed for everything in the kitchen down into the basement, and I tie it into the wrong panel, the wrong junction box. What I tie it into is the timer meter junction box for the hot water heater. Now, if anybody knows what that is, it goes off at 8 o'clock in the morning and goes on at 8 at night. So I leave the job and their kitchen doesn't come on until 8 o'clock at night. And they call my boss and they go, hey, you know, we eat at 6. This isn't going to work for us. I was always getting in a lot of trouble. Always electrocuting myself. It was a mess. Now, you know, I had friends that it didn't even have names toward the end of my drinking. They were called Bear Man and Weezer and Green Man. And, you know, these were like guys that were just like, they had their own parole officers and they were like, you know, aliases and stuff. And these are like my buddies toward the end of my drinking. You know, and talking about like relationships with women. I mean, I wasn't hitting on all cylinders with this. The last girlfriend I had when I was drinking, I met through a prison pen pal thing, which, you know, somebody I knew had gone to prison and met her, and oh, she was a sweet girl and everything, and I started writing to her, and she was like a career criminal, okay? She was like a career, she'd spent like 20 years in prison, you know, for really crazy, violent crimes. Oh, I love you, so she ends up moving in with me and mom, okay? Because I'm living with my mother. They didn't get along, if you can imagine. Got really involved with a lot of serious drugs. One of these times, like, because I was drinking so much alcohol, I really was detoxing every morning. I was a heavy-duty daily blackout drinker. So I'd get up in the morning, you know, and I'd be, like, anxious. I'd be like, you know, like noises and things. And, I mean, just really on edge. And I remember I went to my doctor one day and I said, doctor, you know, I'm always nervous. You know, I really got a lot of stress. And he goes, you know, I think he put his stethoscope on my heart and my heart was going. He goes, oh, you've got a protracted mitral valve that's leading to hypertension and anxiety and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah. And he goes, well, I go, what do you got for that, doc? And he goes, well, we've got this new drug called Xanax. So I go, well, what kind of milligrammages you got that in, doc? I'll take the big ones, you know? And, so all of a sudden I start eating Xanax like candy. I mean, you know, I'm doubling up the prescriptions. I'm weighing them in my hand. I'm not taking two. I'm like, and washing them down with whiskey. The big letters on there, no alcohol. It's like bigger than the Xanax. No alcohol. That doesn't mean me, you know, for amateurs. So I remember allowing myself to be over-medicated this one time. And, you know, actually what it was like a suicide attempt. It really was. I had gotten to the point where, you know, I'm eating a whole bottle. And I ate the whole bottle of Xanax when I was really drunk. And not only did I wake up the next day, but I decided to go to work. Now, much to my boss's chagrin. What happened was, you know, I made it out to the road where the guy was picking me up. He goes, man, Chris, you know, go back inside. You know what I mean? You should know, you know, go back. I'm going to work. Well, I end up getting to work and, you know, there's the window where my boss was. And I remember walking serpentine up to the, you know, it took me like 10 minutes. I'm like walking. He's like, God damn it. Take him home. You know, he like shamed me in front of my peers, you know. Go home. You know? It was just insane. I was suffering from so many things. Now, what really got my attention, and this is just crazy, but the first thing that got my attention was I was at work, and the guy who was in charge of me was a 19-year-old kid. I'm 33. Okay, and the boss puts a 19-year-old in charge of me. I mean, that's how much responsibility I was able to handle. And I was putting a ground screw in an outlet box on the ceiling. And I was shaking so bad that I just kept dropping the screw. I could not do it. I mean, I was shaking so bad. And this kid was looking at me like this. Like, you pathetic, good for nothing, no account, loser. Okay, because I could hear him thinking at you. You know, when you're detoxing, you can hear people think at you. And I knew what he was thinking, and I just couldn't take it anymore. So I signed myself in to a place that I had gone to actually to get one of my licenses back for a DUI. I went to like some outpatient thing. I went drunk every single night to the outpatient, much to the counselor's chagrin. And I would critique the Father Martin movies while I was doing that. Anybody seen any Father Martin movies? Well, as soon as the movie would be done, I'd, Chris, do you have a comment? The Father Martin doesn't know anything about me. You know, and I'd go off and on. Oh, well, thank you for that comment. You know, it was just horrible. But I heard that there was a place to go if you were in real trouble. So that shamed me so bad that out. Now, I'd lost my family, my driver's license 3 times, a million cars. I mean, you know, every car I had was like $100 car. It was, you know what I mean? It was like fictitious plates and, you know, bald tires, no insurance, no registration, because I was busy. And every once in a while, I'd run into like a late model BMW, you know, I'd crash into it or something, and I'd be really pissed at them for having an expensive car. I'd go up and I'd say, "What are you thinking? Buying a $20,000 car. You know how much trouble this is going to be now? I get $100 cars, I crash in my throne away, I get another one." And they usually weren't real happy to, you know, have me share that wisdom with them. You know, they weren't very understanding. But anyway, you know, I go to this rehab, and I sign myself in. And, you know, I'm looking back on it. For many years, I thought, yeah, it was a good place. It was not a good place. They did not do right by me. I don't know whether they didn't know what they were doing, or they didn't have the funding. I don't know, but it was really, really inadequate, because it just didn't offer me anything even close to a solution. And a couple of suggestions: get out of here, go to outpatient, you know, get out of here. And but I really, really wanted to stay separated from alcohol. I ended up relapsing. I talked about that a little bit today. It led to about a 5-month period of the worst drinking I ever had. I'll tell you what a typical day would be. Here's a typical day. I would come to in the morning in the clothes I was wearing the night before, just reeking of vodka or bourbon. And, you know, I'd get, oh, it's time for work. You know, I'd go into the bathroom, I'd do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, I'd brush my teeth, and I'd find my way down to the car, the $100 car. I'd try to make my way to work, all the while swearing to God I'm never going to drink again. I never wanted to feel like this again. You know what those, they're not even hangovers. They're more like, they're more like, you know, you're dying, you know. It's not like a hangover, you're like dying. And I would be swearing I'm never ever going to drink again. And what would happen is I'd rehydrate, you know, with a half a gallon of something. For lunch, I'd get maybe half a sandwich down, and I'd start to feel just a little bit human. And I would say to myself, you know that decision I made earlier about never ever drinking again? That's pretty extreme. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have to modify that decision today. And I would zoom to the liquor store right out of work. I'd buy a quart, and I'd just start drinking, and I would do this whole thing. And I drank with such a vengeance that in about 2 hours, I was tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk in about 2 hours. You ever been that drunk? And this was cutting down on my social life, you know? I mean, you can't do much when you drink that much. Now, what happens is Christmas at the Schroeders, 1989. I'm drinking. My mother's there. My brother and sister come home. Nieces and nephews, cats. I mean, the whole deal. The Christmas tree is decorated. There's presents. You know, there's a fire. The Christmas, you know, stockings are hung by the chimney with care. You know, the whole thing is everybody's home for Christmas, and I get a resentment. And I got really pissed off, and I start walking around the house with a .38 caliber handgun saying, "I'm going to kill all of you. I'm going to kill every one of you." That's not the festive mood that they were looking for, I can tell you. So what they did was they picked up and they took their Christmas elsewhere. I came to, this was a multi-day blackout. It was just horrible. I was as shattered as I've ever been. I remember staggering into the kitchen and seeing a pile of vodka bottles like this in the sink. I didn't even remember buying them. I mean, I must have been out for days. And I started to go into these unbelievable DTs. I mean, hallucinating, violently going into convulsions. I was hearing things. There was little animals running around. There was maggots all over me. There was big animals scratching on the house to come in. I remember laying down on a couch, like this, and a demon came out of the ceiling. Like one of those monitor type demons, like with a bull head and the big horns, and he was coming out of the ceiling to eat my face. I swear, And I go, God, help me. I mean, I cried out from the depths of my soul, God, help me. I'm telling you, when you cry out with that kind of desperation, there's something that hears. I haven't had a drink since I cried out to keep that demon from eating my face. Okay, what happened was I was so shattered, I couldn't even leave the house for a couple of days. I couldn't sleep. I'm coming out of it. And I know that going back to the 28-day thing is not really what I need to do. I need to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous because I had tried AA, but I hadn't participated. I had sat in the seat, but I hadn't done any of the deal. And I just felt inside that that's really my only hope. Now, I had a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls, no heater, no clutch, no emergency brake, no heater core. It's December. And because it has no clutch, I have to find a flat meeting to go to. So I look in the meeting book and I find a flat meeting. And it's in Morristown. And I remember driving to this meeting. Now, because there's no muffler or clutch, there was a little hill going up into the church parking lot. Okay? And 150 people are having cigarettes out on the porch. All my new peers. And I have to gun this thing to get up a tiny little hill. Whoa! Like this, about a mile and a half an hour. And they're all looking like this. Must be a new guy, I go into that meeting. You got to understand, I'm shattered. I haven't slept in about 4 days. I'm there out of desperation. I sit down in a chair, and all of a sudden, somebody hands me a step book and goes, "They're reading from step 12. And I look down the row, and they're reading paragraphs one after the other, and they're coming for me. Okay, I like panic. I'm going to have to read from a book. So I freak out and I go outside. I mean, there's no way. I mean, that's just too much. They want me to read. I mean, that's how shattered I was. And I'm having a cigarette out on the stoop thinking, I don't think I can do this. This is just too much. I don't think I'm going to, It was one of those seconds and inches moments where it could have gone either way. And this guy named Jorge comes outside. He saw me leave. And he goes up to me and he goes, "Kid, what's your deal?" And I go, "Those relapses, those demons, those horrible things running around, those really, really bad." And he goes, "Well, why don't you come on back in the meeting with me?" And I go, "Well, there's a meeting tomorrow night that I'm going to go to, there's a meeting tomorrow night." He goes, "No, he knew what tomorrow meant." So he grabbed me by the arm. He goes, "No, come on back in the meeting." So I didn't want to make a scene. So I went back in the meeting and we sat down in the second row. And I'm sitting there and they're done sharing. They're done reading now. And now they're sharing. So I'm sitting there like this, like totally, totally freaking. And he leans over to me and he goes, "Now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back." And I'm like, "Well, there's a meeting tomorrow night, and everybody raises their hand, everybody says they're coming back." And he's like, "No, raise your hand." He's starting to get loud now. And he's starting to get loud. Now people are looking my way, okay? And you know what's going to happen next? They're going to be thinking at me, right? So finally, I just panic. I can't shut this guy up. And I raise my hand right in the middle of somebody sharing. I've never seen this happen before or since. Right in the middle of somebody sharing, I raise my hand. And the person chairing the meeting is a little confused and shuts the person up who's talking and calls on me. And I said something profound like this. "My name is Chris. Well, the demons are horrible. Relapse, it's just terrible, unbelievable, terrible. thank you. And it's really quiet, okay? And then all of a sudden, the whole room goes, yay! Like this. Now, you know, I took that as acceptance back then. You know, I now know that it's, oh man, that guy's pathetic. I feel so good. Oh, I thought I had problems. Thank you. You know, I know that that's what it is now, but I took it as acceptance, and there was a wall of fear between me and being able to engage in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had too much anxiety, I had too much of that self-centered fear, I just couldn't do it, you know? It was too much to deal with. And by raising my hand and saying I was coming back, I knocked a bit of that wall of fear down. You know, this Jorge guy saved my life. I learned later he had like 7 days himself. You know, I couldn't believe it. So I started to go to meetings. I got myself a sponsor. He told me, go every single night. And I'm going to like a million meetings. I'm doing whatever they asked me to do. I was a secretary here. I was a treasurer over here. You know, I was a no-show GSR here because that's what you do in New Jersey. I was driving people from, you know, treatment to the meetings. I was doing everything. Now, here's the thing, that scared kindergartner, he was still all over me. That repressed, you know, always worrying, really attached to, you know, what you thought of me, and, you know, just really overly shy and overly sensitive. And this went on for about a year. And it was getting to the point where, you know, it was getting to the point where sobriety was becoming untenable. That's what happens to a lot of us who don't engage in the recovery process. Sobriety becomes untenable. We can't take it after a while. Here's what I believe. I believe that if you don't put enough into the 12-step process, you don't get enough power back from the 12-step process to be able to stay. And what happens is you either relapse while you're going to meetings or you leave meetings and relapse then. That's what happens from my experience and my experience working with others. There has to be a level of participation sufficient to get back enough power to be able to stay. I didn't understand any of this stuff at this period of time. But what I was doing was I was buying a lot of tapes. And I talked a little bit about this today. I got exposed to some serious recovery tapes. And what they did was they changed my life. They talked about the actual spiritual mechanicals of a recovery process. You know, a lot of people were talking about the steps and philosophizing about the steps and reading them, and they're up on the wall, and, you know, oh yeah, 12-step program. You know, AA is a 12-step program. Did you ever do the steps? Well, no. Yeah, you know, and there was a lot of that going on. These specific tapes showed me as clearly as I had ever seen the actual answer, the actual recovery process. And I started to do that. And I only started to listen to these tapes and actually put it into application because I had what's known as a sober bottom. There comes a period of time in all of our lives where we're thrown a bunch of challenges. What my challenge was is I met God's will for me in the rooms. You know, she was exactly what God wanted for me, okay? And I fell completely in love with her, and we started to do our dance of death, you know, two ding-a-lings trying to make a bell. And what happened was, she wasn't as interested in this relationship as I was. And she basically told me to go pound. I was not in the spiritual state of mind to be able to handle this really well. And I remember going over to my sponsor's house, and I never did this before. I knocked on his door. I go, phew! And I couldn't even talk. And he knew something was wrong. So he goes, come on in, Chris. What happened was, he asked me, he goes, do you pray? And I'm like, no! And he goes, well, Chris, from now on, what I want you to do is in the morning, I want you to get on your knees. I want you to say a prayer to God to show you the strength and direction to get through the day sober. And at night, I want you to get on your knees and thank God. And, okay, Bill, so I started to do that, and I started to listen to these tapes again, which I had a big resentment to. Now, what happened in my life from that period of time on is basically this. I was unbelievably selfish, like going to a lot of meetings. And, you know, I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm doing this and I'm doing that, but you know, I'm not really helping others. There's a place in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that explains why we relapse. We have a million excuses, but it basically says in the big book that we relapse because we fail to perfect and enlarge our spiritual condition through work and self-sacrifice for others. Now, I wasn't working and self-sacrificing for others, and I wasn't working on my spiritual condition. I start to do these steps, and all of a sudden, I start to recover from alcoholism. Now, there's a difference between sobriety and recovery. There's a huge difference. Sobriety, I really think, is just abstinence from alcohol, just not drinking. And you want to get sober, you can punch a cop, and it'll happen really quick. But recovery is that shift in perspective, that the healing of that kindergartner who was so tortured, the healing of the emotional states, the spiritual states, all the disturbance that's going on in your life. Recovery is a shift. Recovery is a shift toward recovery. Recovery is a shift toward healing of all of those things. And I started to personally experience it through the step process. Now, over the course of time, I was sponsoring people. Anybody that gives good share in the rooms sometimes can get sponsees. Now, I didn't know my ass from a hole in the ground, but people were saying, "Chris, would you sponsor me? You sounded pretty good." And I was saying, "Yeah, sure. You know, here, give me a call before you drink." I mean, I didn't know what to do. And a lot of times these sponsees were drinking on me. Now, I'm involved in the recovery process. And now a lot of my sponsees are drinking on me. Has anybody in here ever had sponsees drink on you? Really makes you look bad, doesn't it? You know, is Harry yours? Do you know he's drinking and he's hitting on the women and he's borrowing money? Yeah, Harry's mine. You know, I had a lot of these guys. So I figured, you know, what the hell? I'm going to get them over my house and I'm going to have them experience what I've been experiencing with an open big book and a pen in my hand and doing these spiritual exercises. So let me tell you what. You want to learn something? Teach it. It's a great way to really learn. So I start teaching from the big book. I don't know that much. I've heard some tapes. But I start teaching from the big book, and guess what? Very, very significant. The people who actually did the fourth and fifth step, actually went out and made amends, every single one of those guys is still sober. They're a card-carrying AA member in good standing. They're working with others, and their quality of life is out the roof. The people who didn't do that stuff and didn't stay consistent with the spiritual processes, they're gone. I don't know if they're drinking or not, but they didn't get enough power back from the 12-step fellowship to be able to stay. They're gone. So I learned something very, very significant through working with others. The solution, the treatment for alcoholism, the spiritual process. What is my life like today? Just this year, I'm just going to name some of the highlights of this year. Being asked to speak here is certainly one of the great highlights. I mean, it would be like if you were a physicist and Albert Einstein said, "I'd like you to do a lecture on physics at Princeton for me," you know, having Mark ask me to do this. Unbelievable. I've been asked to be a board member of the National Council on Alcoholism. I'm a board member of C4 Recovery Solutions, and I've been asked to do an amazing project that involves people worldwide carrying information out to whoever needs it of best practices for addictive illness processes. So we're talking sex addiction, gambling, everything. I'm interviewing the best of the best, and it's unbelievable that I get to do that for a living. I've bought a house. I remember in my first 5 years, people would share like, "Yeah, I bought a house, and then I bought another house. Now I can't sell my other house. I've got real problems." I'm like, how do you get a house? You know what I mean? I got like $5. I bought a house. house. I drive some nice cars. I've got some great friends. You know what I mean? I met somebody in AA, and boy met girl on AA campus, and trouble soon followed. You know, and this is the longest I've ever been in a relationship, 13 years. That's a world record. I was able to start a home group. There's a promise in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that says you can create the fellowship you crave. I've done that with the Burnsville Spiritual Awakenings group. This group has become very, very influential. Many, many things that have happened at Burnsville have gone online and influenced other groups around the world. Unbelievable thing. I just was asked a couple of weeks ago to moderate a political debate with senators and congressmen, talking, putting them on notice that there's a constituency of people out there in recovery that are going to want to know how you feel about certain issues revolving around people in recovery, insurance reform, etc. Putting senators and congress, that's just unbelievable. That's unbelievable. I was living with Mom. You know what I mean? I was just a commencement speaker at drug court. They want me to be the commencement speaker at all these drug court graduations. These are judges and prosecutors. They're calling me up. Hey, you want to help me out? I got to tell you, that's not what was happening in the 80s. I was avoiding them prosecutors. Now I've got like five friends who are prosecutors, for God's sake. I could go on and on and on all night long. All I want to do is tell you, I swear to you, there is unbelievable things in front of you. Sometimes they're not going to be the most comfortable things in the world, but I got to tell you, the journey is worth every single moment, every single effort. Put your recovery first, and you'll have a chance to get it all. That's all I got. Thanks.